Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Discrepancies indicate dozens of Utah voucher recipients are enrolled in public school as lawmakers push for more voucher funding. A GOP lawmaker wants to protect drug discounts. An Elon Musk-funded organization is fighting his bill. And will leaving Park City destroy the magical part of Sundance? Locals and filmmakers share their thoughts. Those are some of the stories we'll be treating on the program today. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. And emerging news reporter Rock Marchant is with us as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Well, let's start with you, Emily. This is a story you did with Carmen Nesbitt, who was going to be on the program, but was called away. There's a press conference ahead of legislative session this morning. So we want to talk, first of all, about vouchers. This is something the Utah lawmakers, Republicans, have been quite keen on, I believe, over the last few years.
Right. This is a program that was started a couple years ago. Lawmakers first passed it a couple of years ago. And since then, they've continued to give it more and more money year after year. This year, they're looking at giving it more money again.
So this is the Utah Fits All Scholarship. And the story you and Carmen did indicated there, I guess there's an audit, I don't know if you call it that, or a check, which found that 177 students at least had been awarded an $8,000 voucher, but were enrolled in public schools. I guess, tell us why that's a problem. I guess these are supposed to go to private schools or homeschools.
Right. These voucher programs, are supposed to be something around school choice is what lawmakers say. So, the $8,000 is supposed to help pay for either private school tuition or for homeschool families to pay for the resources needed to homeschool their kids. The state school board has found that there are a number of kids who or families who have these scholarships for their kids, but their kids are still enrolled in the public school system. This is something that opponents to this have kind of been loud about since the beginning, was that they feel there's not enough of an accountability component. And this kind of goes back to that, where there may not be enough checks to make sure that everyone is using the money they receive as they're supposed to.
I was interested in reading this, that your families can get voucher money for things like piano lessons and other things. It doesn't have to just be private school or homeschool.
I guess as far as that goes, that probably goes more back to the folks who are doing the homeschool aspect. In theory, there are some public schools out there that will have classes where people can work on learning piano. And so I guess that's how people justify it. But there aren't a ton of rules in place as to how people need to use this and how it must be verified that they're using it for schooling.
Now, some of these, many of this it need not be nefarious, right? It could be families who originally signed up and then decided just to go back to public school or once they applied, then made a different decision, right? Just never informed the state.
Right. That's one of the things that, my colleague Carmen Nesbitt did a lot of this reporting, but, she reported that's one of the things that the folks working for the state school board told her is that one of the reasons this could be happening is people will say, get the scholarship and enroll in a private school, and it's not a good fit for their kids. And so they'll go back to public school, or, they'll start homeschool and life circumstances happen and homeschool just wasn't going to work out. And so they re-enroll in public school. So that those are some of the things that the state school board says could be why this is happening. But it is a concern for them when there are families who are getting, this program's $8,000 per child per year. And if they're taking that money and then also their kids are ending up, using up money in the public school system, that's a concern for them.
I'll just mention parenthetically reporting that Carmen is doing. Utah Education Association took the state to court over the voucher program. They say that the state is using taxpayer money, which should go to programs which are available to everybody, and they're putting it to these programs. Private school, for example, private school often costs more than this $8,000, obviously. So not all families could afford that, and that's in front of a judge, I guess, at this point.
Right. The judge heard arguments on that in December. We haven't heard any sort of ruling on that. But the Utah Education Association, which is the largest teachers union in the state, says that it's unconstitutional. So we'll see what happens with that.
In the meantime, Senator Cullimore, he says state lawmakers are hoping to allocate even more money to the voucher program, and he says that it's because of popular demand. Families are wanting this.
Right, and this is something we've heard since before the session, right? I went to a legislative priorities news conference with the House majority, and the lawmaker who initially introduced this bill, Representative Candace Perucci, as well as the speaker, were saying that yeah, they want to grow the program and allocate even more money to that this year. They say that there were 27,000 families that applied for it. And only 10,000 students were able to get the scholarship. And so, they're saying, oh, we need to look at possibly as much as tripling this program. But one of the big concerns is that revenue estimates again this year came in below what was expected. So the lawmakers who are making the budget are going to have to be penny pinchers a little bit. And so they don't think that they can grow the program as much as they'd like to this year. But that is something that they're working to try to find money for.
I assume what are Democrats saying? They're opposed to the concept of vouchers, or they're supportive?
Yeah, they're opposed to it because, from their perspective, it takes a lot of resources away from public schools and even, these scholarships don't cover the entirety of a lot of the tuition of many private schools, and private schools aren't as accessible to everyone in the state. So they don't really see it as a program that serves everyone. They also, like I mentioned before, have brought up concerns about the accountability aspect of it, as far as, it. Whether the state is checking that this money is being used as it should be, especially as like when it comes to homeschooling, if folks where folks just have that $8,000 and don't have to provide any sort of accounting for how they've used that money. So that's a concern that they've brought up over and over, and then just continually being concerned that there's not enough money going toward public education in the state.
And I guess I have to remind myself every time I dive into one of these, charter schools are considered public schools, right? So you can't get a voucher to go to charter school.
Right. And charter schools are there's not a tuition aspect there. And so there those that voucher money wouldn't be something that the families could use there.
Let's move to another of your stories, Emily. Here's the headline: A GOP lawmaker wants to protect drug discounts in Utah, and a dark money group is fighting his bill. First of all, this is Evan Vickers, right? Republican Senator Evan Vickers, who's a pharmacist. Tell me what his bill would do.
Right. So his bill is around the federal 340B program, which was established over 30 years ago under the first Bush administration, to essentially require that pharmaceutical companies give discounts to hospitals and clinics that serve a large money large portion of low-income people and people in rural areas. And there's been a lot of changes over the years in this program, and this is something that pharmaceutical companies for a long time have not been fans of, since they're the ones having to give the discounts. And Senator Vicker's bill would essentially it would make sure it would protect access to this program for participants, whether that's hospitals, clinics, or pharmacies that are contracting with those hospitals or clinics, so that other parties could not interfere in them participating in the program, whether that's making up certain contracts or whatever that makes it difficult for them to obtain 340B drugs that are these lower price drugs. The reason that this law was made was so that these hospitals, as they're providing care for low income, uninsured patients, or patients on Medicaid, Medicare, is so that those hospitals can take the cost savings from these drugs and spread it out to give more charity care.
So there's an ad up targeting, I guess, Republicans, Republican lawmakers. This is a group called Building America's Future. Who are they?
Right, so that's a it's a political nonprofit. They describe themselves as, quote, a pro-MAGA conservative nonprofit organization. And the ad that they've put out centers around President Donald Trump's agenda as he's getting into office. They claim that protections for 340B interfere with his agenda. But we really don't know where the money funding these ads is coming from. This, because it's a political nonprofit and not something like a political action committee, there's not rigorous reporting requirements. They don't have to file financial reports as frequently. They do have to file them annually to the IRS, but not as often as, say, a political action committee would to the Federal Election Commission. And they don't have as stringent standards as far as when it comes to reporting, disclosing donations to their organization, and some of the ways in which they spend their money. So we really don't know where this money is coming from. We do know that in October, it's been reported that tens of millions of dollars has been donated to this organization by Elon Musk, who, everyone's pretty familiar with his name at this point. He's the world's richest man, and he was tapped by President Trump to head the new so-called De Department of Government Efficiency. But, I chatted with someone who worked as a consultant for him, and they said they really don't think this would be a priority of his. Because they believe that getting rid of the 340B program would lead to bailouts for hospitals across the country. We don't know. We don't know where this money is coming from or where these how these ads are being funded.
What are the ads saying?
They're saying that as President Trump gets into office, that if the 340B program remains in place, it's going to make it harder for him to implement his agenda. The two points it brings up is that, and I'm going to quote from it here. It's, quote, being used to subsidize healthcare for illegal immigrants and pay for gender transition for kids, which is, after describing that program, which is pretty broad as far as what it provides, that's a pretty narrow view of it and characterization of it. And it's a pretty brief ad. These ads are going out on TV and on podcasts. And yeah, there's not a lot of context as to what's going on here in the ads.
You talked with the head of the Utah Hospital Association, Frances Gibson, who, by the way, was a former majority leader of Utah House of Representatives. You note, I'd forgotten that. What is he saying?
Well, he has said that, the hospitals, that this is a huge program for them. They support it. And that as far as rural hospitals go, it would be hard for them to keep their doors open if they didn't have this program. He was saying that, it is something that is meant to help patients, to help the lowest income people in our state. But also he pointed out, there isn't any taxpayer money that's going toward this. This is something that pharmaceutical companies have to do. And he said that, that a lot of the opposition to this program and, possibly these ads is coming likely from the pharmaceutical industry.
So where is Senator Vicker's bill right now?
Right now, it's with the Senate Rules Committee. So that means it hasn't been given out for further consideration. So we'll see, if they hold on to it there or if it is distributed for further consideration and if these ads impact how lawmakers vote on the program.
We have another story we'll talk with you, Emily, about in the next segment. But before we go to break, I just want to have you, and I'm just springing this on you, apologize. This is from a week and a half ago. You mentioned Elon Musk. You had an interesting story about, here's the headline, how Elon Musk props up Senator Mike Lee and how the billionaire benefits from the Utah. Of course, Senator Lee is much on X these days. Of course, Mr. Musk owns X. Tell me just very briefly the kind of the relationship there.
Right. So my colleague Robert Gerke and I, we went through a lot of Senator Mike Lee's personal accounts posts on X. He posts from an account called Based Mike Lee, where he will use a lot more slang and maybe be a little more spicy than he gets on his official Senate account or his campaign accounts. And as we went through these tweets, we found that the account he interacts with the most is Elon Musk's. And there was an outlet called Roll Call. They actually did an analysis of Elon Musk's tweets back in October, and they found that the member of Congress he interacts with most is Mike Lee. I decided to read through every tweet in which Mike Lee, or every post in which Mike Lee mentioned Elon Musk, to kind of see, how their relationship has formed, and found a number of interesting things, including Senator Lee advocating for Elon Musk's businesses, including, essentially threatening foreign regulators who've tried to regulate his companies, and just them and Elon Musk promoting Mike Lee's political objectives. It's pretty interesting when you dig into the tweets to see just how close they've become over the last several months.
You might be one of the few beyond the true believers who've gone through every one of Senator Lee's tweets.
It did take a while,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. The places are that you're reporting lead you, I guess. All right. We're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. We'll get into talking with emerging news reporter Brock Marchant following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchand. Brock, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A little later in the program, we'll talk about Sundance. Sundance might be leaving Park City, might be leaving Utah. And so you got some comments from current participants in Sundance. But right now, I want to talk about another story of yours from this week. Here's the headline. Utah reports of ice sightings are driving fear. Here's what experts say you should know. So obviously, you know, a new political era, President Trump has taken office. He's going about fulfilling his promises. And that's created a lot of fear among the immigrant community.
Yeah. Like you said, you know, the Trump administration came into office and they loosened some restrictions on ICE, you know, through executive orders, through policy changes. And, you know, that's left. And in other cities throughout the nation, they've conducted larger operations. So people in cities such as Salt Lake will see that, and you'll see, you know, local social media channels or local people in other areas who are concerned or who have, you know, seen ICE, seen these operations. And it's hard to say just how heightened they've been or how increased they've been, but there's definitely been what seems to be an increased awareness, if nothing else, especially given the change in regulations. So yeah, it's definitely something that has popped up in recent, I guess, in recent week or two since President Trump took office.
You talked to Holy Cross Ministries. First of all, tell us what that is. I'm familiar with Holy Cross Hospitals. I guess this is a remainder from when they closed their hospitals?
Yeah, so it's a nonprofit group that kind of spawned from after they closed their hospitals. From what the CEO told me about it, it was something that people who were involved in the hospitals did as they wanted to reinvest some of that money they got back into Utah. They looked towards where there was a need, and they found one in the immigrant population. So they described it as a wraparound nonprofit service. They offer, you know, legal advice where they can. They offer a variety of resources, especially to immigrants who might be in need of them.
So here's a quote. People are terrified of sending their kids to school, scared of taking them to get a flu shot. I guess there is a lot of fear out there.
Yeah, exactly. It was interesting, you know, with that quote, they talked about how, you know, the first few days after these executive orders and policy changes came into place, the phones were ringing and they wouldn't stop. And then they got a lot more quiet and people weren't answering the callbacks. And they said it's almost been a chilling effect as people have started to feel more and more of this fear.
So you have some answers to some questions here. First of all, what can people do now to preparing ahead of time? What are some suggestions they have?
Yeah. And I, to take a just a small step back, it was interesting speaking with both, you know, the volunteers and staff of Holy Cross Ministries, as well as, you know, Salt Lake City immigration attorney Lynn Tran Layton. And they kind of talked about how one of the things that we're seeing now is where if ICE has a targeted arrest for someone who might be here without the proper documents and has some other criminal background, they can now, and we've seen it in other areas of the country, they can now have collateral arrests where somebody who might not be that particular individual could be arrested in that operation. And so that's been one of the reasons for that heightened concern. But speaking with Holy Cross Ministries as well as Tran Layton, they did recommend several things people can do if they're concerned. And I think probably one of the most broad things they said is, you know, kind of have a general emergency plan in place with a family, like you would for almost like a natural disaster. They pointed toward what's happened recently in other areas of the country and saying like, okay, well, if something happens where you're not going to be able to be with your immediate family, who's going to pay the rent? You know, who's going to keep the electricity on and the water in the pipes? Who's going, like, do your children have extra medication? Is there a way they'll be able to get that? So one big thing they said was have that plan in place. Another was, you know, have any immigration documents together in a place where somebody else can get to them. And they also mentioned, you know, it's important for people to consider their rights, you know, as they're concerned, as they're worried about potentially being detained or arrested, and to remember what they're constitutionally obligated.
And then, of course, they talked about what to do if you are detained or approached by ICE. What are some suggestions?
Well, generally, one of the things Tran Leighton really reminded me of is, in a broad sense, you have the right to remain silent. And she talked about how you also have a right not to sign things without an attorney. And she mentioned how people will be given a document to sign, and they can accidentally or without knowing it sign themselves into deportation proceedings. Then she also talked, she and Holy Cross Ministries talked about some of the differences in warrants. If ICE comes knocking at your door, you can ask if they have a warrant. And if they have an ICE administration warrant that might allow them to arrest somebody, that's not necessarily the same thing as a warrant that's granted by a judge, a state or district judge that allows them access into somebody's home or even private areas of their business. So kind of learning about those differences, knowing about those rights, seeking maybe legal advice if someone's very concerned. There's resources on where people can do that at the Utah Immigrant Advocacy Coalition website. But those were all some steps that they said people can take, in case they do confront ICE or ICE confronts them.
And what about if I shows up at your workplace?
Yeah, so it was pretty similar. And I spoke with Holy Cross Ministries, Tran Leighton, and also Cyriac Alvarez kind of about that. And it followed very similar if they show up to your home with the warrant. It's a little bit different where there are private and public spaces. Something that the people I spoke with from Holy Cross Ministry said employers can do is clearly, mark which areas are public, which areas are private. Maybe a lobby the public is allowed into. Maybe a parking lot the public is allowed into, but a break room, the private offices, that's a little bit different. So, that's something that can be done, is establishing which areas the general public can go into and which areas they can't. And, just like they would need a warrant to search your home, that's kind of necessary for a business. And they also spoke about the importance of, well, if ICE approaches a business, and wants to asks for like scheduling information or information about employees. They talked about how important it is to have, a system in place. Who's allowed to fulfill these requests or handle these requests, and who shouldn't? The way they put it, it's not necessarily a good idea for a business to expect a secretary to answer ICE questions about their employees. Who does that go to? Is it an HR manager? Is it someone higher in the company? And even when it gets to that person, what laws does the company need to follow before disclosing information about their employees? It's a good conversation to have with an attorney or someone who can let you know what you legally can't disclose, or certainly don't have to. So, those were some of the steps.
Brock, at the very end of your story, this is a question I've had. You take 2022 data, I guess the latest we have available. In the state of Utah, we have about 300,000 immigrant residents. About a third of those we think are probably undocumented.
Yeah, and this is from the American Immigration Council. I've heard different estimates from different groups, different bodies, but this is what the American Immigration Council did have based off of 2022 data. And this is a group that Holy Cross Ministries pointed to me, or pointed out to me. So that was an estimate that I did include.
So you can find this story at sltrib.com. And I notice, Brock, this has been translated into Spanish. You get the Spanish version at sltrib.com as well.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll bring you back a little later in the program. I want to turn back to Emily Anderson Stern, a Statewatch reporter. Emily, another story, very interesting. You've been covering this. Here's the headline: The feds sued Utah over poor care for trans prisoners. Lawmakers now look to end treatment altogether. Of course, we all know the political winds are blowing in a very different direction than they were just, a month or two ago. on the federal level, President Trump issued an executive order, I guess, banning all, transgender or transition care. What is the state looking to do?
The state's looking to do something sort of similar, maybe not quite to the extent that President Trump is doing, but essentially they're looking to make it so that while people are incarcerated, they can't initiate a gender transition. So they can't, request to start receiving hormone treatment or to initiate a gender affirmation surgery.
Remind us about this case. I don't know the status of the case. It's possible the Trump administration will just drop this, but the Biden administration brought this case against Utah.
Right. So last spring, there was a lawsuit that was brought by the Department of Justice against the Utah Department of Corrections and the Utah Department of Health and Human Services for allegedly discriminating against a transgender woman who was incarcerated at the state prison for essentially making it more difficult for her to access gender-affirming healthcare and delaying that healthcare. And they documented different instances in which that healthcare was not properly administrated and or administered. And they eventually, this created a mental health crisis for this woman who had gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is essentially, where when someone their gender identity doesn't align with their gender assigned at birth, how it causes a lot of mental and emotional distress for them. And that continued to get worse and worse as she had difficulty accessing this care. And eventually she performed a self-surgery because she couldn't get the care that she felt like she needed.
You note in the story that gender dysphoria is a condition covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, is this law, if it's passed, is this going to be taken to court?
Well, that's the basis of the lawsuit, right? Is that she should have her access to that care protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act because she has gender dysphoria. And so it's discrimination to not allow access to that or to make it more difficult for her to access that. At this stage, President Trump has largely, he's frozen all lawsuits from the civil litigation, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And that's where this lawsuit came from. So we really don't know if it'll continue. It's likely it won't. But it highlights some of what will be happening around the country. So we're not sure the extent to which the Americans with Disabilities Act might still protect people with gender dysphoria against, delays in treatment or their treatment not being, their medical care not being treated in the same way that medical care for other conditions would.
You mentioned an Idaho bill. I guess it was passed last year or recently. How does Representative Lisenby's bill compare to the Idaho bill?
So, as I've been digging into this lawsuit and, guessing that it likely won't continue, I sought some records on some of what was going on at the in Utah's correctional facilities. And, there's a committee that decides whether people requesting gender-affirming care can access that care. And I was able to get a hold of their agendas for their meetings and saw that over the last several months, there are a number of times where they discussed that Representative Lisenby was weighing bringing similar legislation to what's been passed in Idaho. The Idaho law is a lot more broad than what's happening in Utah. They essentially passed a law that says no public money can go toward any gender-affirming care. So, you know, that includes state Medicaid, it includes hospitals that are publicly owned. If, you know, physician salaries are being paid by the state. And it also includes correctional facilities. But there was a lawsuit brought by some transgender people who were incarcerated in Idaho. And a judge made it a class action lawsuit for all of the transgender people incarcerated in Idaho, and essentially put the law on hold and said, you know, these people need to still be able to access this gender-affirming healthcare.
So this Utah legislation, where is it at this point?
Right now, it's in front of the House of Representatives. And so, you know, it's just moving through the process. It was passed out of a House committee. And, you know, it'll likely pass out of the House. Last year, you know, this is the fourth year in a row that there are restrictions affecting transgender people that are going through the legislature. It would be, you know, if they this law and other laws pass, it would be, you know, the fourth year in a row they pass those. So it's largely expected to pass. Last year, lawmakers also passed a law that restricts where transgender people can be housed. So that's where it is now, and it'll likely keep moving through the legislative process.
All right, Emily Anderson Stern, thanks for telling us about this. Statewatch reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Let's take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Sundance, and we'll talk about that with Brock Marchant. And at the end of the program, of course, the underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn to Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchant. Brock, you talked to a lot of people, I guess, attending Sundance this time around, they're musing on the possibility of Sundance leaving Park City. Remind us about that. What's Sundance Institute up to there, and what are the potential plans?
So, you know, this is something that has been up in the air since they, you know, initially started considering a step out of Park City, at least publicly doing so. I think it was around, you know, after Sundance last year, sometime in the spring. And they're staying in Park City. You know, they're here this year. They'll be here next year. In 2027, there are three options that the nonprofit arts group is considering. You know, they'll either go to Boulder, Colorado, Cincinnati, Ohio, or there's a combined bid between Salt Lake City and Park City that would relocate a lot of the festival to Salt Lake City, but would keep some in Park City and would keep the festival, you know, in Utah.
So some of the people you talk to remind us why there might be a move. You talked to one director who, you know, hooray, he got his movie into Sundance, and now he's got to raise, I don't know, $14,000 just to attend.
I had the opportunity to, you know, walk Main Street in Park City and talk to some of these festival goers, filmmakers, and locals about their thoughts on the potential move, what it would mean to them, and if they think it would be a move in the right direction. No pun intended. But Phil Cox, the one director I believe you're referencing, talked about how, you know, he basically said, I've given it all for this movie. You know, he's the director of a documentary, you know, showing people who had to leave because of a war. And he was like, yeah, you know, it's good to be here. This is a pinnacle, is what he described it as. It's a pinnacle for filmmakers. But he said it's very hard for someone who independently goes and creates a film to then have the funds to get to Park City, where lodging expenses are high. You know, it's not a cheap place to find accommodations for the week of Sundance. And he talked about how that's just an added challenge and has been for him and his team, how they had to, go to donors, really try to find that money. And he described, he also talked about how, he was at Sundance, I believe it was about 10 years before as well. And he talked about how, the festival has changed. The way he said it, there was a sense of anarchy, with this independent film festival that just isn't quite there as much anymore. So it was interesting getting kind of his insights on it.
So you talk to some locals, you talk to filmmakers, you talk to this institute, kind of the three different groups. Let's stay with filmmakers. What are some other filmmakers saying about Sundance?
It was interesting speaking to people who've been there for, almost 30 years compared to people who've been there for like their first year. But some of the first year people had thoughts that were relatively similar to Phil Cox's in that, it is expensive, and that can make it less accessible to somebody running with an indie film, running independently. They talked about the prestige of Park City, and it does have these really cool, majestic vibes. It's in a serene place up in the mountains. They talked about how they liked it. It has a very centralized main street. It's easy to gather. And that was another concern Phil Cox had. If it's kind of sprawled out, the feeling that Sundance brings might not be there. So they said, there are these positives with Park City. There's a reason this festival's there. But again, most of their concerns largely came down to, well, this is a festival, for independent film. How can we make sure it's accessible to people who are making independent film?
One of the filmmakers noted that if you put the fe a festival in a very large city, it can kind of get swallowed up by that city. I guess the of the potential places to go, that the Institute did eliminate the very largest cities.
That was a concern. Like I briefly mentioned before, you go to a larger venue and you do risk that not having that main street feeling. You risk maybe, public transportation isn't going to be able to get people around like it can in Park City. It's concerns that they definitely did bring up. And I think Phil Cox put it in a very, to go back to when I spoke with him, he put it in a very good way where he was like, the city has to want it. If the people in a city want Sundance and are willing to, host this festival, host these filmmakers, if they're interested, then he said he essentially thought like, okay, that's going to be a factor as to a city that can make a good host, if the city wants to have it, if the people are willing. If they're not, it was more of a concern for him in that, yes, city could just easily swallow it up and it could lose kind of the feel.
What are locals saying? You talked to a bunch of locals.
It was largely, it kind of followed along those lines where they liked having it in Sundance, or excuse me, they liked having Sundance in Park City, but they understood the difficulties. I talked with one person who attends Park City High School. And she was like, it's cool to have it here, but also it's a lot harder to park while it is here. But then we talked more and she mentioned how every year, they screen one of the films at the school. And she described them as more of the artsy films, but she was like, I think it's an important educational opportunity for students to see those films and to kind of learn more about other people's experiences. So I thought that was very interesting where, for locals and for filmmakers, it's almost a, it's a two-sided coin. There are negatives and benefits to whatever happens. So a lot of good memories with Sundance too. Her mother, going back like 30 years, met her husband unexpectedly at a party for Sundance. So it's a bittersweet, it's a very bittersweet.
You talked to one Utah filmmaker who said, it's great to have this here. This it His name is McCoy, and he's a professor of photography at Brigham Young University. This was interesting to me. He said it's statistically almost impossible to get your film at a Sundance, but it's a great goal to have as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, I did this story in conjunction with Sean Means, I should add. So that might be an interview he would have more insight on than I would, but I did speak with some, aspiring filmmakers in Utah who kind of shared like, their appreciation of having Sundance in Utah because it brings much of the film industry that they otherwise wouldn't be able to have contact with to them. They weren't locals to Park City even, but they came and they said, yeah, like, it's a great event to come to. It's a great thing to aspire to. But even not feeling ready to submit a film to Sundance Film Festival, they were happy to be there, happy with the opportunity that they had to connect with other people who they otherwise might not meet. So there definitely is that aspect where, if Sundance leaves Utah, it also leaves Utah filmmakers. And that's, yeah, it would be very unfortunate for them.
So what's the timing on this? 2027, I think, was when the festival would be in the new city.
Yes. So we're expecting a decision later this year, potentially this spring, I believe. And yeah, it'll be in Park City next year in 2027. That's when, that's when the new bid will, or they'll when they'll go to a new venue potentially, or the split between Salt Lake City and Park City.
What are the folks in Utah? Are they hopeful that the Salt Lake slash Park City will be the winning bid?
It was interesting. A lot of them didn't really share solid predictions. One individual, an entertainment attorney who's been involved with film distribution at the festival for a while, said he's confident that, the institute's going to make the right choice. So I'm not sure what the general prediction would be. It'd probably be depending on who you ask, but it'll be interesting for sure, no matter where it ends.
So I guess to remind us, besides Salt Lake slash Park City, is Boulder and Cincinnati.
Yes, that's correct. One
Yeah,
of those three.
and it seems like of the three, one of them is not like the other. Cincinnati seems a kind of a different choice to me, but they
It
must have some
definitely does.
attractive characteristics to the institute.
Yeah. You'd have to ask the Institute more about that, but definitely.
Well, thanks, Brock, for telling us about this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Let's turn to our underplayed stories of the week. We'll start with Emily Anderson Stern. What's your underplayed story of the week?
I want to spotlight one from my colleague Robert Gerke that I think, may have gotten lost in all of the chaos of the legislative session. But there's a bill out that, would disband the State Records Committee. The State Records Committee is responsible for making decisions on appeals when the state doesn't want to hand over records that people think should be public, and instead send all of those questions to one person, an administrative law judge. And some people have concerns about how that might impact transparency in the state.
All right, that's from Robert Gerke. Check that out at sltrib.com along with everything we talked about today. Brock Marchand, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, along the similar lines of Emily, it's been a busy week, so it's easy for a lot to get lost. But one story that I think, might not grab attention as immediately, but is definitely important, is from Carmen Nesbitt. It's National Results Are In: How Utah Students' Math and Reading Scores Stack Up Against Other States. It's essentially what's known as the national report card or the nation's report card, showing, where gaps persist in Utah, where things have fallen behind in the state or nationally. And I think it's, among other things that are happening that are, fast moving, I think this is definitely important as well to kind of provide some context to, the education.
All right, check that one out at sltrib.com as well. Well, on Behind the Headlines, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. And we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune Emerging News reporter Brock Marchand. Thank you to Brock.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you join me again next time. Thanks, everybody.